Remember, it's not just Elizabeth Holmes. He was one of Harvey Weinstein's biggest lawyers for years and years and years. His reputation has definitely taken a hit.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Tuesday, January 31st. Today, Eric Gardner joins me to talk about a curious legal theory surrounding the collapse of FTX. Are celebrities like Tom Brady, Larry David, and Steph Curry guilty of using their fame to get customers to invest in Sam Bankman-Fried's shady crypto exchange? Super lawyer David Boies seems to think so, and he's suing them to prove it. But will his argument survive in court? Eric has the details. And later, it's hunting season on Wall Street. Bill Cohan stops by to discuss the feared activist investor who's taken a multi-billion-dollar stake in Salesforce and might be coming for Mark Benioff's head. We'll hear about all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Thanks for listening to The Powers That Be. If my voice sounds a little hoarse during this podcast, it's because I came close to losing my voice screaming at the refs during the fourth quarter of the Bengals game. They should be in the Super Bowl and they're not. But that's a topic for another day. Today, I'm joined by Eric Gardner. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. I can advise you about whether you can sue the refs if you want.
I bet you could. Well, speaking of lawsuits, there's an unusual one going on. It's about FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. And obviously, lawsuits abound. Federal investigations abound with this. But there's one famous attorney coming at this from an interesting angle. And that is David Boies, who has obviously been a lawyer for big politicians. He was a lawyer for Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. He's been involved in so many big high-profile cases. He's actually going after a bunch of famous people, Tom Brady, Larry David, Gisele Bündchen, Steph Curry, for using their fame to entice customers to open FTX accounts. And as we all know, people lost millions and billions of dollars by opening said accounts. Eric, tell me about this lawsuit. You talked to David Boies. It sounds like a bit of a stretch that Tom Brady would be in some kind of legal jeopardy for hawking FTX. But what is his theory of this case?
Yeah, it's absolutely a stretch. Now, first, let me say, like, why isn't he just suing FTX? Or why isn't he suing Sam Bankman-Fried? And the reason is that, you know, if he sued FTX, you know, the bankruptcy would get in his way. Or if he sued SBF, the criminal case would get in his way. So, you know, what he's trying to do is take some sort of other sort of route towards holding people responsible for what happened. And here, his theory is that, you know, people enticed consumers to put money in this platform. They're the ones who used their fame to really, you know, vouch for this company that was dealing with some shady stuff. And so they should pay as well. It's an interesting theory. I am very, very dubious and skeptical about whether this is going to fly, but it's interesting enough that, you know, I had to speak to David Boies about it and hear what he had to say and hear about his travails, because, you know, it's pretty interesting, and he has made some progress, at least, you know, when it comes to Mark Cuban.
Well, before you, we get to Mark Cuban, because that's an interesting angle too. Like, what did he say? Like, how did he defend this case? If Tom Brady is representing FTX to his clients and like posting about it on social media, we all know that Tom Brady is not a financial savant. He is in the sense that he's made a lot of money, and all of these people manage their money and have become wealthy using various entities and portfolios, etc. But like, if a famous person was hired by like a pharmaceutical company and made promises about that medicine, like, are they supposed to know if it doesn't work or if it's flawed or if it's going to fail or if it's going to hurt people? That seems like a dubious case to make in the court of law, in the US especially.
I think so. I think people are sophisticated enough to know that when people are paid, they're doing it for the money. They're not necessarily doing it because they believe in the product. But on the other hand, these are people who really did vouch for FTX, and they took money. They even like were partners in this. They took their compensation in terms of tokens, and they were a little bit more integrated than maybe your usual celebrity endorser. And I guess so. At the end of this day, I'll be very, very surprised if he's successful. But, you know, crazier things have happened. Maybe there's still insurers out there who will just pay to make him go away. And so maybe the ultimate determination of whether he's successful or not is not whether he can convince a jury, but whether or not he can score some settlement. Right now, I'm sure he has designs on, you know, interrogating all these celebrities. He told me he just sent out a subpoena for Tom Brady. So he's going to hassle them. He's going to make their lives a little bit miserable. He's going to cause them to be embarrassed. And maybe, you know, someone will throw some money his way to make him go away. We'll see. It's certainly interesting.
So there's like Mark Cuban, you mentioned, he is also the subject of a possible lawsuit from David Boyce because his crypto entity. What's going on there?
It is definitely a lawsuit. It was actually a lawsuit that happened before the FTX thing, because what Mark Cuban did was he had the Dallas Mavericks become the official crypto partner of Voyager. And if you're not into the crypto space, Voyager is a brokerage firm that had millions of customers that went bankrupt. It was actually a platform that FTX itself almost bought in bankruptcy in September before FTX went bankrupt. Huh. So it's a big thing. There are billions of dollars at stake. Voyager kind of went kaput because it overextended itself with loans and then got into a liquidity crisis. I don't think anyone suggested that what Voyager did was criminal, but David Boyce himself suggests that it was all, you know, sort of a Ponzi scheme. And now he's attacking Mark Cuban with pretty much the same theory that he's attacking Tom Brady in the FTX case. And what's interesting here is that, you know, this case has been going on a little longer, and he's scheduled to depose Mark Cuban this Thursday. Huh. To get him in a room and start interrogating him. Now, Mark Cuban's lawyers are fighting like hell over it. They're also questioning why it is that he's being sued in Florida when, you know, everyone knows that Mark Cuban's a Dallas person. And that's led to some pretty entertaining court briefs where, you know, Mark Cuban swore that he basically had nothing to do with the state of Florida except, you know, like owning property there. And then David Boyce's team, they dug out the fact that he was the keynote speaker of a crypto conference last year in Miami. So they told the judge, you know, this might be perjury. It's really, really fascinating. And, you know, I don't know where this kind of goes from here, but, you know, if I know Mark Cuban, I know he's not going to back down, and he's going to, you know, throw everything he can in defense.
Does David have some kind of vendetta against cryptocurrency? Like, you see, like, the actor from the OC who's just, like, going around testifying that this was all a scam? Or, you know, the other way to look at this is, as much as people in crypto were trying to get rich quick, and maybe none of them were as smart and talented as David Boyce, but like, we talked late last year about how he's part of a lawsuit against Google claiming that Google Chrome doesn't actually have an incognito mode. And so, you know, one of the lines I think in that piece was like, he's collecting some billable hours, and this feels like another way to collect some billable hours. Is he also looking for ways to get rich quick at this point and just get his name in the headlines? Or like, why is he so passionate about this?
Well, to be clear, Google is definitely taking up more of his time than this FTX stuff. He not only is he after Google on the privacy front, but he also has an antitrust case that kind of teased what the Justice Department did against Google last week. David Boyce told me that the Google stuff is definitely the biggest thing on his docket. But that being said, David Boyce is the head of a big plaintiff's firm, and they try to get as much business as they possibly can. And in this FTX stuff, this crypto stuff, you know, we're looking at multi-billion dollar frauds where lots of people lost money. And so it definitely makes for an interesting class action if you can figure out the right legal theory to bring. And I think that's what he sees. He's trying stuff. The guy is 81 years old.
He's 81? So oh, wow.
Yeah, he's 81. So, you know, it's interesting to me. I asked him, you know, do you think that you're going to retire anytime soon? And he told me that basically, you know, when he thought about it, he was going to take things intermittently, but as long as he had great cases that he was going to keep going.
Huh.
And he saw this is, you know, kind of an interesting case that he was going to, you know, take a shot at.
I mean, Boyce, I think, became really, really famous, obviously, during Bush v. Gore, you know, being he was one of Gore's attorneys during the recount, et cetera, in the Supreme Court case. But he also, like, helped go after Microsoft and break them up, right? I think the Theranos thing and, like, his portrayal in the Hulu series, which was great, kind of made me think that, like, he's party to these lawsuits lately, or he's coming up with legal theories, at least, to go after tech actors. And I'm wondering, like, do you think that's like any kind of like atonement for the Theranos thing, or at least his really shitty portrayal in the miniseries? Because all of this activity that Boyce is up to, like, happened in the last year after this the Hulu thing came out, and a lot of people learned, or at least via that show, that he did a lot to protect Elizabeth Holmes.
Remember, it's not just Elizabeth Holmes. He was one of Harvey Weinstein's biggest lawyers for years and years and years. His reputation has definitely taken a hit around the turn of the century when he was, you know, representing the government to go after Microsoft, and mm-hmm. he was, you know, Al Gore's lawyer. I mean, he was literally probably the, you know, most famous attorney in the country. He was, you know, a hero to many. And certainly over these last few years, people have kind of had a reassessment of him and his career. I don't know whether what he's doing right now is atonement. I think that, you know, it more kind of fits the category of, you know, this is what plaintiff's lawyers do. They take on big cases. For him, it's, you know, he takes, you know, not just big cases, but pretty challenging ones too. And so I think that's better to read it there, that he is trying to collect a big money pot rather than to make some sort of amends for, you know, Theranos and Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, well, I should note in your lead, you say that you talked to David Boyce right before he was stepping onto his 184-foot sailboat en route to St. Bart's. So he's not wanting for money at this point. That sounds delightful. Eric, thanks so much, man. Talk soon.
My pleasure.
When we come back, Ben Landy talks to Bill Cohan about Salesforce and the investor gunning for Mark Benioff. Hey, Powers That Be listeners, I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you a curated list of gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. I use Etsy all the time and have for years. I bought my brother some artwork. I bought my wife some jewelry. I even bought a rug for our living room on Etsy. I love it. But there's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for friends and family members around the holidays or birthdays in my life. And sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for a buddy who's just as into Cincinnati sports as I am, a hot cup of Joe Burrow mug. That's right, I found that on Etsy. It's amazing.
Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
Welcome back to The Powers That Be. I'm Ben Landy here with Bill Cohan. Nice to see you, Bill.
Great to see you again, Ben.
We've been talking a lot recently about investor activity on Wall Street, I suppose in part because there are so many companies that became bloated or made strategic miscalculations during the market bubble. Money was cheap. So now it's a target-rich environment for these activists that are coming in as valuations have plummeted. You and I have been talking a lot about Nelson Peltz, the billionaire who's taken a big position in Disney. And now we've also got Jesse Cohn at Elliott Management, who's taken aim at Salesforce. They've got a multi-billion dollar stake there and a list of demands. First of all, Bill, what is the reputation of Elliott Management and of Cohn? And then what do you suspect that the firm actually wants out of Salesforce?
Well, I assume that the firm wants what every activist investor wants, which is a return on their investment. They want a higher stock price. They want to make money in as short a time frame as they can, because then their internal rate of return will be higher and they can use that information to raise more money, which of course is how they keep the flywheel, if I may use that term, running. So no matter what they're saying or doing, all they really care about is making money, which is, you know, hardly a surprise. You know, their reputation is, I've gotten to know them fairly well. I've interviewed Jesse. I've interviewed Paul Singer, the founder, Jonathan Pollack, Gordon Singer, Paul's son. You know, they all seem, when you interview them, when somebody like me interviews them, they all seem charming and rational and calm and intelligent and highly motivated. You know, they don't necessarily show their fangs to me, but, you know, they obviously can be quite, shall we say, determined, even ruthless. They have plenty of examples of their ruthlessness. You know, one of the best examples is this, is what they did with Athena Health, which was a healthcare company in Boston that was run by Jonathan Bush, who is related to the two former presidents. And Elliott and specifically Jesse Cohn, you know, wanted Athena Health to do all sorts of things, which Jonathan Bush was resistant to doing. And eventually they decided they needed to go scorched earth on Jonathan Bush and sort of dug up, you know, decade-old divorce records about Jonathan and his wife at their most extreme, and, you know, accusations of his bad behavior with her. I gather they've since reconciled, even though they're still divorced and they're raising their children together. But, you know, again, it was enough to turn the tables on Jonathan Bush. He was replaced as CEO. And the thing that I find so interesting about that case is that sort of 6 months later, after they got rid of Jonathan Bush, Elliott teamed up with another buyout firm to actually buy Athena Health, to actually own the company, which is not necessarily something that hedge funds usually do. That's something private equity funds do. And I think Elliott, by the way, has a hybrid model in that regard, in that they are willing to buy companies as well as take positions in them and advocate for changes. So Elliott ended up buying Athena Health. They bought it for $5.7 billion and recently sold it to Hellman & Friedman, a big buyout firm in San Francisco, for $17 billion. So they must have made a fortune on Athena Health. So, you know, they are very smart. They also can sometimes be, how shall we say, gracious and ecumenical, believe it or not. They bought Barnes & Noble, the bookstore chain, and installed James Dount, who had turned around, I believe, Waterstones bookstore in the UK and brought him over here to try to turn around Barnes & Noble. And, you know, Ezra Klein the other day in the New York Times wrote a piece about how marvelous Barnes & Noble is becoming again. I think that's probably the gist of it. And so, you know, why Elliott bought Barnes & Noble when it was obviously struggling to compete against Amazon, I don't know. But then they brought a real bookseller with real street cred and a string of accomplishments to run it. And I think slowly but surely he's having some impact, although hard, of course, to compete against Amazon in the book world. But that's sort of the two sides of Elliott. You know, there are many sides of Elliott. I think they've, you know, used to be far more ruthless and argumentative and demanding, you know, and I think over the last few years they've tried to soften themselves a little bit. And so far with Salesforce, they're, you know, sort of taking a supportive position with Mark Benioff, but obviously they want to make money.
Well, yeah, I'm curious about Salesforce and Benioff specifically. I mean, Salesforce stock is down not that much compared to other tech companies, but they have experienced a lot of the same problems as other Silicon Valley companies over the last 2 years or so. They've hugely overhired during the pandemic. They went on this buying spree where they bought Slack for $28 billion, which was a huge multiple of that company's revenue. And then not only did they overpay, there's been reports of internal tension over how Slack was integrated. You've had executives leaving, the co-CEO, Bret Taylor, Slack founder, Stuart Butterfield. All these guys are deciding suddenly they want to spend more time with their families. So what is the playbook if you are Benioff and you're trying to right this ship? Do you worry about playing ball with the Elliott guys? Could they be coming for Benioff's job as well?
My view of all of these guys, especially the ones who are big cage rattlers, like Nelson Peltz, like Elliott Management, like Bill Ackman, you're generally, you know, sort of better off reaching some sort of accommodation with them as soon as you possibly can to get their noise making and distraction out of the system, because there's only so much bandwidth that any one person has. And, you know, I don't know Mark Benioff. I mean, you know, thank you, Mark, for buying and rescuing Time Magazine. You know, thank you for trying to make a difference in the media world. Thank you for being one of the largest employers in San Francisco and building a tower that is architecturally significant and I think had some weird problems that you resolved. But right now, you know, you've lost two of your key management team. You've got to deal with a bloated cost structure, a slowdown in purchase of your products. You know, you've got to, the last thing you need is sort of a fight now with Elliott Management, who's got endless resources to make your life crazy. And it's, you know, not entirely clear what they want other than a higher stock price. But my you know, experience in reporting on all of these guys is, you know, the sooner you kind of appease them, you know, and appease is an interesting word because sometimes even appeasement doesn't really end the story. But as soon as you reach an accommodation with them, the better, you know, you can carry on and focus on what's really important, which was, you know, riding the ship of your business and not dealing with these extraneous gnats and buzzing that comes along with these activist investors who increasingly, by the way, don't really even have to own that much stock to become quite troublesome and bothersome and annoying. And, you know, if I were Mark Benioff, or if I were Bob Iger, I would, you know, not engage in a proxy fight with Tryon. I would not, and maybe I would probably want to, by the way. My ego would probably, you know, want to stand up to them and show them that, you know, I'm bigger and tougher than they are. But I just think that's a losing strategy. It just always is. You know, I mean, there's some activist hedge fund managers who, you know, I think, like, for whatever reasons, I don't fully understand. Dan Loeb can, for instance, be more benign than others when he wants to be. You know, he sort of comes and goes more quickly than the others. He seems to have reached, an appeasement of sorts with Bob Chapek at Disney. He's still in that deal, as far as I can tell. But he's, you know, letting Nelson Peltz do the cage rattling at the moment. He comes and goes more quickly. There are others who just stick around and bang the drum and get on CNBC and make their case until they get their way. And that can just be extraordinarily distracting for any CEO, for any board of directors. And I just would not, you know, they really have a very successful, high success rate of getting what they want, which is either making money or making things happen, making executives leave, getting the kind of CEO they want in place. And, you know, I don't think Mark Benioff is at risk of losing his job because he's a founder, but, you know, and they don't own enough stock to replace him, I don't think. I haven't studied that closely, but, you know, reaching an accommodation is probably the quickest and safest way to, you know, put this in the past.
Well, like you said the other day, Bill, it's hunting season for these guys, the activist investors who are out there looking for these soft targets. And it is a real reversal of fortunes for Benioff after, you know, as you mentioned, he bought Time Magazine, he built the tallest skyscraper in San Francisco. Maybe that's just the circle of life for these kind of companies like Salesforce that get too big too fast and then activate the activists who come in to right-size them. But Bill, thanks as always for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13, and produced by Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.